It's Philosophy Talk.
One of the things that really struck me at thinking about Hurricane Katrina, what it teaches us about race and class, is how race and class structure our moral imagination in this country.
America is a classless society.
It's how much money you've got that matters.
The whole issue of equality is not really on our radar screen politically. I think it's very easy for middle-class Americans, and especially for wealthy Americans, to live in a bubble and not realize what it's like for people who are in poverty.
Race, class, and inequality.
Our guest, Elizabeth Kiesch from Duke University.
If you're one paycheck away from poverty, as a lot of Americans are, your circumstances are entirely different when you're made more vulnerable by something like Katrina.
Recorded before a live studio audience in Portland, Oregon.
Race, class, and inequality. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we've taken Philosophy Talk on the road again. We're in Portland, Oregon, at the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting, the radio and TV studio, in front of a live audience.
Our thinking, however, starts on the Stanford campus at Philosopher's Corner.
And from there, we migrate to the air, the TV air and the radio air, and then from there to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org.
Today's program is made possible by Oregon Public Broadcasting, and we're really grateful to this group for making it possible. And we're very pleased to meet you folks from Oregon. You've been our faithful listeners, and it's really good to meet you in person.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, folks. Today, our topic is race, class, and inequality in America. So, John, those three big things. What philosophical questions do those three big things raise?
Those three big things, you could ask, what philosophical questions don't they raise? Just start with equality. That's one of the key words in the Declaration of Independence. But what do those guys have in mind? Do you think that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson intended to break up their plantations so every American citizen could have an equal share? I don't think so.
You're thinking of economic equality or inequality. And that's one kind of equality or inequality. But there's also political equality. I think they were thinking of every American, well, at least some Americans, being equal citizens, having an equal say in governance, right? You know, one person, one vote.
Right.
At that time, one white male, one
yeah,
vote.
But right, all white men
one
are created
property
equal.
White male, one vote, right?
Well, true. And so that's an American ideal. Equality before the law, both with respect to when the law is arresting you, everybody gets treated equally, or when you're helping form the law, representative democracy. Also, equality of educational opportunity has over the years become very important to Americans. But I kind of wonder, if you have great inequalities in wealth, so you have wealth influencing the courts, influencing the legislature, influencing the quality of schools that the wealthy's children attend, can you really have those other kinds of equality without real economic equality?
That's a very good question, especially when the inequalities of wealth track things like race, so that the wealthy people are all white and the not-so-wealthy people, many of them are non-white. And if that's systematic, you have a big problem.
Well, we don't want to overgeneralize, Ken. I know some black people that live in Los Altos, which isn't exactly Povertyville, like you.
There's also questions about class. I mean, you might say, well, if you have rich people and poor people, you have class distinctions. But you might think you want a society in which differences in class don't make a difference in what kind of education you get, what kind of health care you get.
So one conception is economic inequality is okay. Within limits, it may be necessary to really get the most productivity out of the talented few. That's an old idea that, by and large, hasn't been challenged by American philosophers. They haven't been as egalitarian as they might be. But everybody agrees that it shouldn't track race and class. You shouldn't say that economic inequalities are based on race and class as opposed to talent and skill and hard work.
You know, to give us a kind of philosophical retrospective on philosophical thinking about equality over the ages, I know the one and only one person who can do that in short compass. That's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, during perhaps the worst crisis in American history, Abraham Lincoln said, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth in this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Well, he didn't mention women, but you get the idea. Also, at the time he gave the address, black men and women had not really been entered into the equality equation. Equality is a recent concept. Until the 18th century, it was assumed that human beings are unequal. Here's Martin Luther, for instance, from the 15th century. Some must be free, some serfs, some rulers, some subjects. The concept of equality gave us both our flawed republic and the French Revolution, so it remains problematic. Sure, the world abounds with pro-equality proverbs and sound bites. Bernard Baruch said, both poor and rich attend funerals. Compare that to the pre-democratic Roman Seneca, who wrote, the sun shines even on the wicked. I'll put it that way. It's not exactly a reassuring thought. Is equality a given? Neoconservative Irving Kristol said, democracy does not guarantee equality of conditions. It only guarantees equality of opportunity. Anatole France issued a similar thought, a bit more cynically. The law, in its majestic equality, forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg on the streets, and to steal bread. Firebrand Camille Paglia, the trauma of the 60s persuaded me that my generation's egalitarianism was a sentimental error. I now see the hierarchical as both beautiful and necessary. Efficiency liberates. Egalitarianism tangles, delays, blocks, deadens. Take that, equality. Balzac wrote, equality may perhaps be a right, but no power on earth can ever turn it into a fact. And there are many who want to keep equality a fiction. The Marquis de Sade would have none of it. If the objects who serve us feel ecstasy, they're much more often concerned with themselves than with us, and our own enjoyment is consequently impaired. The idea of seeing another person experience the same pleasure reduces one to a kind of equality which spoils the unutterable charms that come from despotism. And here's what radical feminist Andrea Dworkin had to say about despotism's unutterable charms. A commitment to sexual equality with males is a commitment to becoming the rich instead of the poor, the rapist instead of the raped, the murderer instead of the murdered. Does equality even exist? Hannah Arendt, it is not true that equality is a law of nature. Nature has no equality. Its sovereign law is subordination and dependence. Sam Johnson, so far is it from being true that men are naturally equal that no two people can be half an hour together, but one shall acquire an evident superiority over the other. And how far does this alleged equality go? The People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals considers us guilty of speciesism. Animals are our equals, according to PETA. On the other hand, as Orwell ironically put it in Animal Farm, all animals are equal. But some animals are more equal than others. Take that, PETA. I gotta go.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest today is Professor Elizabeth Kiesch. She's the director of the Keenan Institute for Ethics at Duke University. She's the author of many, many works on human rights and ethnic conflict around the world. Elizabeth, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, Ken.
Elizabeth, Americans pride themselves on America being the land of the free, the land of opportunity, and the land of equality. Should we?
Not at all, unfortunately. It's inequality in America is immense, and it's growing in many respects. And I think one of the most depressing aspects of it is the extent to which it is profoundly structured by race. I think recently Hurricane Katrina really showed us this when we looked at what happened after the hurricane. Blacks were disproportionately affected by the hurricane. But I think one of the things that really struck me thinking about Hurricane Katrina, what it teaches us about race and class, is how race and class structure our moral imagination as Americans.
What do you mean by that, our moral imagination?
Well, you know, David Brooks from the New York Times mentioned that floods are like civic examinations. They wash away the power structures, reveal what's underneath. And you remember the press coverage after the hurricane, that there was all this amazing stories about people rampaging in the streets, hundreds of bodies in the Superdome, all this kind of super racialized sort of moral imagination. Most of which, almost all of which, turned out not to be true. And it's happened before. After multiple disasters in the past, it's turned out that we have imagined that the other, often blacks, were misbehaving. And it's happened after the Galveston flood, after multiple floods.
Let me see if I say what you're saying. So when we imagine other people's circumstances, if we're committed to equality, I guess the differences between us shouldn't make any difference to how we imagine, how we consider what they deserve, what kind of treatment they should get, what they should have access to. But are you saying that somehow the fact that we imagine, say, that whites imagine blacks as the other, the moral other, not morally the same as us, somehow shows up a lack of commitment to equality? A lack of commitment to equality?
Yes, I think it shows up all the time. I think it shows up very starkly when something like Katrina happens. So that instead of thinking thinking that it's you in that situation. Many Americans thought, well, it's people very different from myself.
You know, Katrina wasn't the first thing of this kind. Right here in Portland, there was used to be an area that was mostly inhabited by blacks called Vanport that was built during World War II for ship workers. Portland was a very segregated city until after World War II. There was a flood in about 1948. The dikes broke, and Vanport, which was in the flood basin, was flooded, and all those black families had to find refuge in the rest of Portland, which was almost all white. And you say these kinds of things are a moral exam. I think Portland at the time felt it probably failed the exam. On the other hand, a lot of people did step up to the plate, and that very event is also the beginning of Portland's becoming what it is now, a very liberal city. I don't know how racially integrated it is, but at least compared to other American cities, it does pretty well. You see any bright side to Katrina?
Well, maybe it's a wake-up call. I suppose in that sense it could be. It depends on what we make of it, in a sense.
I mean, yeah. In one way, I mean, it's the same kind of thing, though. I mean, Americans do think of themselves as committed to equality. I mean, America thinks of itself as in some sense, at least political equality. I'm not sure about economic equality. And you might think, well, Katrina shows up to ourselves that the commitment isn't everything it's cracked up to be, that we don't really live up to this commitment.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's an important dialectical moment, as they say in Hegelian philosophy, right?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, but it depends on whether we draw the lesson. You know, I mean, Barack Obama talked about this, about how there were a lot of people who were saying, well, why didn't people get out of town? And I think it's very easy for us middle-class Americans not to realize that you know, if a hurricane is coming and you don't have a credit card, you don't necessarily have a car. A lot of folks in New Orleans didn't have a car. You can't just sort of gas up your car and go and check into a hotel. If you're one paycheck away from poverty, as a lot of Americans are, your circumstances are entirely different when you're made more vulnerable by something like Katrina.
So in a way, the most basic kind of equality is the idea that each of us can imagine being another one of us. We're all equal in the sense that we should be able to put ourselves in each other's shoes. Even if we don't have economic equality, even if we don't have equality of opportunity, we ought to be at least able to relate to what it's like to be these other people. And these examples suggest that to a certain extent we haven't even achieved that.
I think that's right.
I want to take you back to our earlier discussion about the distinction between political equality or inequality and economic equality or inequality. And John was suggesting that you really can't have political equality without some measure of economic equality. Do you agree with that? I mean, or do you buy John's line that you can't really have political equality without?
I don't think you can. I mean, you can have formal equality. It is one person, one vote in this country. But when you're really talking about voice, when you're talking about having a sense that you can shape your destiny, a sense that you can you know, maneuver, you can produce a better future for your children. I mean, there's a 5-to-1 difference in wealth in this country on average between whites and blacks. It's a 2-to-1 difference in income, but it's 5-to-1 in wealth. And so when you think about what a difference that makes in terms of what kind of future you can imagine for yourself. I mean, we have this myth about anybody can grow up and, you know, run to be president.
Well, George Bush did it.
Well, so. All right. There you go.
Well, you know, the one important good that there ought to be equality of is the things you can aspire to. Hmm. And that's something that we really haven't achieved here yet. That is, what roles can I aspire to be? And we take pride in the idea anybody can grow up to be president. To a certain extent, that's true, but only a person who can imagine themselves growing up to be president. And Bill Clinton in Poor Hope, Arkansas, could do that. It's not so clear that a kid in the Ninth Ward of New Orleans could do that. So there are equalities even more fundamental than economic equality, I guess.
I mean, you're talking about, we might call what you're talking about equality of aspirations or something, yes, like that. Equal access to possibilities or something like that. But that is a question, how do we guarantee that? Since people differ in their talents and their abilities, in their degree of stick-to-itiveness, so how can it possibly be the case? You can't aspire to be a Major League Baseball player in the same way that I could. Half when I was younger, say.
Well, you mean because you're more athletically talented?
Or something like
or,
that.
Or because there's this stigma about being white when you try to get in the bigs.
Oh, yeah. This is Philosophy Talk, a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the radio and TV studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland, Oregon, in front of a live audience. Our guest is Professor Elizabeth Kiesch from Duke University. Our topic is race, class, and inequality in America.
We've been reviewing the facts about inequities due to race and class in America. In the next segment, we'll consider the question, who's most affected by these inequalities and inequities?
Race, class, and questions from our live studio audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Peter Tosh and Equal Rights. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're discussing race, class, and inequality in America. Our guest is Elizabeth Kiesch from Duke University.
We're here at the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland, surrounded by a studio audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
So, Elizabeth, I want to ask you. Some people think of life as a race for goods, you know? I mean, we're all trying to get the goods. And suppose I run the race well and I win the race. Why should I care whether about the losers of the race, the people who don't have what I have? Why should I care? It's a fair competition. I ran, I won.
Well, there's a question. Is it a fair competition? So, I mean, I think one thing we have to recognize is, and it's, of course, hard sometimes to recognize if you're one of the winners, that we start from very different starting points. If you really think that, if you believe in sort of the American ideal of equality of opportunity, and you look at whether it's health care or whether it's education, whether it's housing, security, you know, if you're a middle school child and you're worried about getting shot, as opposed to a middle school child who's worried about, you know, acing the AP test in 4 years' time. It makes a huge difference. So I think that's one issue, is how fair is it? But, you know, the other thing is that I think people should care, because inequality in America, and particularly these sort of systematic inequalities on the basis of race and class, produce enormous wasting of human potential. For instance, think about how many young black men are incarcerated and what they could accomplish if they were educated properly, if they could contribute to society, to their families, to their communities. And all of that, you know, even from a sheer sort of economic self-interest perspective, think about how that could contribute to the American economy.
I certainly agree with you. But I do think there is a large segment of American society that thinks our society basically is fair, and people basically get the outcomes that they deserve. The people are in prison because they break laws. They have the freedom not to break those laws. People are poor because they don't work hard. People are rich because they work hard and save. And it's fair. Convince me that it's not fair.
Well, all right. Let me tell you about, I take my students on a field trip to Washington every year, and we go to the Capital Area Food Bank, and I'm sure there's food banks in Oregon as well, and they do a little exercise, which is an amazing eye-opener. It's called Hunger 101. Each of them gets an envelope, and they open it up, and there's somebody who lives in that area, and they find out what that family's income is. And then what they have to do is deduct, you know, how much rent is, how much paying gas for your car, how much, you know, clothes for your children are. And then at the end of the day, they have a certain amount per month. They have to divide that by 30, and you find out how much money you have to spend on food. And what they find out is that these families have like $1.82, 45 cents to spend for a family of four, family of five per day. And it is an incredible eye-opener. And there are very few middle-class Americans who understand that there are a lot of Americans who are working who face that kind of prospect.
Well, I think that's true. And I suppose some kids have the reaction, well, they should have chosen richer parents. But I think most people, when they have that experience, their eyes are open, or when they see what happens at Katrina. But in a way, aren't we the victims of our own good fortune? We have a fairly broad middle class. Kids go to schools at public schools with kids from largely different incomes. There is a lot of equality of educational opportunity within that that range, right? When I went to the public schools in Lincoln, Nebraska, they were fairly decent schools, and there were kids that were poorer than me and kids were a lot richer than me. But we don't see the extremes unless you take somebody on a field trip like that, or the news takes us on a field trip to Katrina. And it's those extremes that really make the whole thing unfair.
Yes, and also the whole issue of equality is not really on our radar screen politically either.
Well, that's certainly true. You know, you're listening to Philosophy Talk, folks, and we're talking about race, class, and inequality. And we want some questions from our live studio audience, and we have one now. Sir, why don't you tell us your name and then where you're from? And
my name is John Blank. I'm from Portland.
And your question or comment?
Well, I'd just like to correct what I think is a misapprehension around the table here, which is that it's the blacks who are poor and the whites who are rich and middle class. If you think about it, blacks are maybe 10% of the population. Most poor people are white. And I think that covers up a commonality that whites and blacks ought to be aware of, or at least on the part of whites ought to be aware of, and which we share with black people.
I think you're certainly right. You're certainly right about the numbers that most poor people are white, but disproportionately black people are poor.
Yes.
I mean, so that's they're both facts there.
A third of black children are in poverty. And so you're absolutely right. But I think the impact on American blacks of poverty is far greater.
Well, and this also comes down to this aspiration equality. If you're poor and white, it may be easier to identify with people that aren't in your situation. If you're poor and black, particularly if you're in a ghetto like Oakland or someplace where the role models that are foisted upon you aren't very positive, it's much more difficult. But having said that, Mr. Blank is absolutely correct.
I think race is one thing and class is another thing, and they interact in complicated ways. But I do think we have a society. Let's set aside race for a second. I do think we have a society. We don't like to talk about class, but class differences make a huge difference to the way your life goes in this society. You could envision a society in which you say, okay, look, I know they're going to be rich and poor, but what I want to do is make the distinction between being rich and being poor less consequential. So it doesn't have to be the case that if you're poor, you go to a lousy school. It doesn't have to be the case that if you're poor, you get lousy health care. Right, so you could have rich and poor, but then try and ameliorate the consequences of that distinction. What do you think, Elizabeth?
Absolutely, and we're not doing that. I mean, whether it's the minimum wage, whether it's education, the fact that in the U.S. Education is linked to property taxes. It's funded by property taxes, which means generally, you know, the rich get richer, and the children of the rich get better educated. So you know, from generation to generation, the gaps actually get broader.
Deep inside the American consciousness, I'm wondering if, I mean, we tell ourselves these stories that we're committed to equality in a certain way, at least to equality of opportunities, because we all think, well, if the race wasn't fair, right, but we tell ourselves that the race is fair, but then we don't do anything to ameliorate the consequences of class distinctions. I mean, the political will is lacking. People don't want to pay taxes. Everywhere you look, taxes are being cut. Right, or they're being raised on the sly, but the explicit stuff is what was the last presidential candidate who ran on a platform that said, "I'm going to raise your taxes"? That was Walter Mondale, and he got creamed.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And even Clinton, who did raise taxes, ran on the platform, the middle class tax cuts.
Right.
Well, but in a way, the issue, I mean, is a little skewed, I think. Most of our tax money goes to the federal government, and the federal government has no real constitutional responsibility for education. That's really weird. I mean, all of these good intentions of the American people, I think, are to a certain extent stifled by a funny system we have that means that most of our money goes to fight stupid wars.
You know, we have done better in the past, though. I mean, think about something like the GI Bill after the Second World War, which put a lot of families into the middle class. You know, they went and they served in the war, and then they were able to have a mortgage. They were able to get educated. We've had the War on Poverty, and that had actually an impact, and it's eroded ever since. But actually, poverty levels fell substantially in the United States in the 1960s.
We have another question from our audience.
My name is William. I wanted to add that it seems like in dealing with equality that there's two main focuses being differentiation versus devaluation, meaning a difference in equality that's differential is simply a physical difference or a difference that we may all lay claim to, whereas a difference in devaluation is how collectively we would perceive the difference. And could you all speak on that?
Yeah,
difference?
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, differentiation might be like the point before earlier about whether John could become a Major League Baseball player. It's not like that's actually has a negative impact on him, that he doesn't have that capacity. Well, oh, excuse me. I'm just assuming. I'm making assumptions.
If I'd been a successful Major League Baseball player, I could be a big beer distributor by now.
Sure.
Maybe I'd own one of these breweries that Portland is so proud of.
True. Whereas devaluation is, I do think, for instance, I don't know whether people would agree that increasingly, I think it's true of sort of the last 20 years in America, that poor people are devalued in this country. I mean, that our political rhetoric devalues. You know, think about welfare queens. Think about all these sorts of things which became acceptable. Also, you know, incredibly inaccurate in the sense when you look at how much welfare goes to corporations as opposed to poor people.
But it's a really complicated thing. America's a complicated stew because it seems to me that part of the abandonment of the war on poverty was, first of all, the government proved extremely inefficient. And part of the time at which the war on poverty got abandoned was when the Democrats were in power and inflation took off and Vietnam turned out to be a mess. And so the people who cared about those things were just totally discredited for a while, right? And then the Republican strategy racialized all this stuff because they knew that they could peel off Southern poor whites by racializing all these questions, right? And we're living with this ever since.
I think that's right. I also think that, I mean, you know, it shouldn't just be seen as a sort of Democrat versus Republican issue also, but I actually think that some of the things that maybe Republicans care about might point to good anti-poverty strategies. So, for instance, building wealth, enabling people to own their homes one of the most effective things that people can do is microlending. They actually invented it in Pakistan, but now they're doing it in Durham, North Carolina, and in Mississippi is giving poor people the chance to build up credit, to take out loans, and then to build up their wealth and start to close this wealth gap.
So in fairness to George Bush and the Republicans, this ownership society isn't a bad idea, and it reflects what America has been pretty good at, which is once you kind of get into the lower middle class, making a lot of a lot of equality within that range. I'm thinking mostly of our system of home mortgages that we take for granted, but it's an incredible equality producing thing. But it doesn't touch the truly poverty.
We have another question from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'm Jeff. I'm from Vancouver, Washington, across the river. With respect to political equality, what role can greater openness and transparency in our government play in counteracting the access provided by great wealth?
That's a darn good question.
It's a great question, yes. I think, for instance, I mean, everything from campaign finance reform to you know, just transparency in campaign contributions, for example. You know, one of the things that's been, I think, very depressing in the last few years has been the way in which we've had, you know, Marx called it a government by the executive committee of the bourgeoisie, and I think that's actually been happening with legislation. For example, environmental legislation being developed by the oil companies. You know, so greater transparency, I think, could first of all could reveal the ways in which wealth is distorting the political process.
You might call it government by the Marx Brothers.
But, you know, I think this is very complicated. Just as I think it's hard for a society to manage the trick of enabling the poor to have equal, say, educational opportunity, equal health care, all that stuff. It's also very hard for a society to manage it so that the rich don't have disproportionate influence on the political institution. And if you can show me a society anywhere that's achieve both these things, I'll move there.
But it's not clear that we couldn't do a lot better, and there's a lot of interlocking things. One of our liberties that we're very proud of is freedom of speech, but that's been linked by the Supreme Court and by thinkers, conservative thinkers, but thoughtful people, to no restrictions on how you can convert your money into speech. In other words, the Supreme Court has struck down limits on spending, campaign spending, on the grounds of free speech. Now, that's something that, if the Supreme Court is right, I think that there ought to be amendment. It ought to be rethought. It ought to be clarified. I think the whole idea that freedom of speech means unlimited power to use the mass media to convince people of your side just can't be allowed to continue.
Even if you're not using the mass media, just think about the cost of organizing people, right? Organizing people costs lots of money. It's a complicated thing. And people who have lots of money can organize. They can get their friends together. They can do that. The court is not going to – we're not going to have a constitution that says, oh, you can't organize. You can't use your money to organize. And organization is power.
I mean, I think, you know, there are some promising counterexamples. I mean, there are people who are using the internet. There are examples of citizens' movements that have been quite effective without spending a lot of money. So I think it can be done. But I completely agree with you, Ken, that it's there's a lot of distortion through money.
There's a certain amount of illusion that we ought to challenge here, since we question everything except our listeners' intelligence. I mean, look at the way we're organized in the U.S. The U.S. Senate, every state has two members in the U.S. Senate. If you look at it, that means big cities, which is where the poor and the lower classes, at least the effective lower classes, because you can live better in rural America on the same amount of money, tend to live, have far less representation. The typical California person has, California would have over 100 senators if we had the same number of representatives per person that they have in Delaware. That's probably not going to change, but the incredible distortion in one of the most powerful agencies of our government by the way we're set up is never questioned, and it's completely unequal.
Well, another thing that I wish were questioned more is CEO salaries.
Again, I understand, and I agree with you. But counter the argument that a certain degree of inequality is essential for economic progress, because the incentive structure has to be there.
I agree with you. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I think what we need to pay attention to is both how low the threshold is, and so I think that's why the fact that the minimum wage in this country is so incredibly low is really distressing and appalling. And the other is how great the inequalities are. And I mean, don't tell me that the fact that, you know, many CEOs earn what 400, 500 times what workers earn, that actually reflects their value added to the company?
This is Philosophy Talk. We're discussing race, class, and inequality in America. Our guest is Elizabeth Kiesch from Duke University.
We've been talking about inequality and who is affected by it. In the next segment, we'll move to the question of what should be done about inequality in America.
More about race, inequality, and class, and questions from our live studio audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Marvin Gaye and Inner City Blues, Make Me Wanna Holler. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. This week's topic: race, class, and inequality in America. Our guest is Elizabeth Kiesch from Duke University.
Elizabeth, from a philosophical point of view, or the point of view of an ethics institute, or of Duke University, or whatever point of view you want, how do we get this moral imagination in gear? How do we make Americans care about equality across class and racial lines?
Great question. I think each of us can try to do, you know, within our own circle of influence, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a parent. I mean, I described this Hunger 101 exercise, which every American, I think, should go through. I mean, whether it's in your church. So I think there's ways of trying to to break out of the bubble. I think it's very easy for middle-class Americans, and especially for wealthy Americans, to live in a bubble and not realize what it's like for people of who are in poverty. I think there are things that we can do policy-wise as well, and be happy to talk about that. But I think that's an incredibly important first step.
Let me ask you a slightly off-topic question, though. When I start thinking about this, is trying to train people's moral imagination to imagine the situation of the other in a way that's sympathetic. You know, one thing, though, is that the world is teeming with the oppressed, impoverished people. It just teems with human suffering. Yeah. Should we really have a special concern for equality in America? I mean, we've got the in America part, but is that really morally defensible to care more about equality in America than equality in the world at large?
Yeah, what about a child in Darfur? Yeah. What about a child
You deal with ethnic conflict all over the world. I mean, there's massive suffering all over the world.
Yes, there is massive suffering. And, in a sense, of state borders are morally arbitrary. So why care about Americans? And yet it seems to me that there is a special shame that in the wealthiest country in the world, we are not able to lift people out of poverty. And it seems to me that it can't possibly be one or the other. We're not doing a good job on either of those things, either working to alleviate poverty and deprivation abroad or at home.
Well, I think if as an individual you feel that it's indefensible to care more about the poverty of a child because it's American than someone in Darfur, that's fine. And by all means, put your efforts into helping that child in Bangladesh or Darfur. On the other hand, as a practical matter, that same person will know that the best chance of alleviating poverty as far as what the American people as a whole are going to do is to bootstrap on our feelings of loyalty to our country and neighborliness and so forth and so on. I mean, there's limits to the moral imagination that most people are going to be able to exercise. So in the end, I don't think there's a conflict.
That's true. And if we could so affect the moral imagination of Americans that when they imagine one another in a kind of shared polity and a shared life, they imagine one another as entitled to equal opportunity, equal aspirational opportunity, and John's lovely thing, then we would have achieved a lot,
Yes, and I think it's important, again, I mean, I said this before about not seeing this as purely a province of the left or what, you know. I think politically, the more we can see that we can draw on the moral resources and the moral rhetoric of people across the political spectrum and draw that together and say, you know, we believe in an America of equal opportunity. We believe in an America where there is not this obscene wealth gap. We believe in an America where you know, children of single parents have aspirational equality.
We have another question from our live studio audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your question or comment, and who are you?
Hi, I'm Michelle, and I'm here from Portland, Oregon. And I've been following this conversation, and it's really interested me how we've talked about we as Americans have a very strong commitment to equality here in this country. But then I'm wondering, too, especially as you started to transition into our obligations, what are our obligations to export that abroad? It appeared that our foreign policy, especially in the mid to late 90s, when we became involved in the war in Bosnia, it seemed to be morally right. But what about our exportation of our system of government right now forcibly into the Middle East? Does that make us just a little bit more equal than other people and a little bit more right?
Do you want to comment on that?
Well, you know, I guess the only thing I would add, there's a lot that could be said about what's going on in Iraq. But let me just add another thing, which is think about who's fighting for America in Iraq and think about the class and race inequalities that our armed forces represent. And so I just want to put that point out as well, that it's we, you know, who's actually bleeding and dying.
So that's another theater of inequality. The government imposes burdens on us from time to time, right? And you might think it should impose those burdens without regard to race or class differences. But you know, in one way you might say, well, the draft did that, but Americans did not support the draft, but, you know.
They didn't support the draft once it became a lottery system, and it was impossible for the rich to game it anymore.
That's exactly right.
And the half-life of the Iraq War, if they started talking about a lottery system, would
that's
be
exactly
about a
right.
week.
That's exactly right. No, but that's yeah. making the point that I want to make. Look, the political system is responsive to us, right, but different of us differentially. So if that shows, look, that shows we're willing to support a war that imposes the burden on a certain class of people, but if the government imposed that burden equally through a draft that didn't allow escape hatches, that war would end tomorrow. You know, so again, how do we get but how do we get the comfortable to have a new immoral imagination in which they say, look, this war, one of the things that's wrong with it is the way we're fighting it, who we're making fight it, right? How we're distributing this burden. Now, how do we do that?
How about requiring more philosophy classes?
Well, there you go.
There you go. I think it's also a question of leadership. You know, when you read FDR's speeches about how you measure the moral quality of a country by how it treats those who are the poorest and the most vulnerable, or you read his Four Freedoms speech, where freedom from want was one of the core freedoms he thought that every human being was entitled to, and you think, you know, when has an American politician used that kind of rhetoric in the last 50 years? So I do think we also, you know, this may sound like a, you know, great man theory of history sort of thing to say, but I think we need some leadership that's going to call attention to these issues.
Let's see what our audience thinks. Hi. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'm Terry Joyce from Vancouver, Washington, and I agree with you, Doctor, that we could put our weight and our fortune and put the war on hold for 2 weeks and support a national health insurance for years to come. The inequality will still be there. The poor people will still be there, but at least they'll feel better. At least they'll be able to function. And that's my observation.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a deeply important point. It's not necessary. It doesn't have to be the case that poverty tracks so tightly the consequences for your life in a community. I mean, in some ways, European democracies are a mess. In some ways, they are a mess. But they have made it the case that if you're poor, you can still get decent child care. If you're poor, you can still get decent health care. If you're poor, you can still have a decent pension. I mean, they have to tax themselves out the wazoo, but they've made that choice.
Yes.
And we haven't made that choice.
Yes, I've just spent 6 months in Australia, and it was just incredibly striking to me what a difference it makes to live in a society that has a decent living wage. You know, for one thing, I mean, this was very striking to me, was that the people who were doing the, you know, cleaning up at the mall, for example, there was no racial tracking there, you know, because these are, you know, decent, well-paying jobs. And so, you know, people are, you see people of all colors and all ethnicities in all kinds of jobs.
Again, I don't want to be a contrarian because I kind of believe this. But the counter argument to that is, look at Europe. Mm-hmm. It's economically stagnant. Its unemployment rate is huge. It's nothing like the economic dynamism of the U.S. And many people believe that our tolerance of economic inequality is part of the engine of that economic dynamism.
Well, it's part of the engine, but I don't think and there is a difference. And we have a different philosophy of starting business, of an entrepreneurship, and none of that should be denied. There's no point denying it. But differences in healthcare don't help us at all in comparison to Europe, and differences in educational opportunities. So
yes.
Surely we've got the wit and imagination here in America to combine the good parts of both.
And to take our entrepreneurial, take that entrepreneurial spirit and make it open to people from the inner city, for example. I mean, I think that's
these mini grants are a good idea. So they're in, mm-hmm. they're in Durham. You want every family to have its own little cigarette manufacturing operation. Yeah, you know, grow their own.
So,
one problem kind of shifts into another in our
things are complicated.
Listen, I'm going to make you the absolute monarch of America for a little bit.
Oh, thank
so that
you.
What you can say, what you say goes. Okay.
What kind of salary does that bring?
only long enough to implement your policies that will improve our moral imagination, improve economic inequality. What do you do?
Wow. Well, I would, you know, like the gentleman said, health insurance. I think health care. I think education. I would change the funding system for education and make it a federal responsibility. I love the idea. I think several people have suggested it actually in the policy debate of having a fund for every American child that would be available to them when they turn 18. I think that would be one of the most amazing equalizing. Policies that we could put in place.
You would think that schools, because we're talking about children, right? Mm-hmm. And we think children, the fate of a child's life should not be so directly tied to the wealth of his or her parents. That seems perfectly reasonable.
Yes.
And you would think, I mean, you would just sort of an ideal just thinking about it, that it would be kind of easy to make all the schools good, because all it takes is money and dedication and good teachers, and, you know, it takes resources. But look around America. There's such disparity in the quality of the schools. So again, I wonder, how deeply are Americans really committed to this thing they say they're committed to?
But, you know, the thing about Americans, though, is certain times, crunch times, they're incredibly generous. We are an incredibly generous society in terms of charitable giving, actually, personal charitable. And you know, it's interesting. Poorer people often give a greater percentage of their income than richer people do. So I think there are aspects of the American character that could be harnessed for this project. It's just that this project has not been part of our political culture and part of our rhetoric.
If I had a lot of time and I was a good photographer and wasn't so lazy, I have a project in mind. I would go around to all the towns and cities in America, and I would photograph the five buildings that insurance companies and banks have in the city that are most wonderful, and then five schools, right? And just publish a book. The schools, you know, I mean, just take Palo Alto. That's a pretty rich place, and our schools are a lot better than the ones in East Palo Alto, because I occasionally go over there on these work groups. But compare them to the banks and the insurance companies. So the wealth to have certain institutions really taken care of nicely exists, and it's not impossible. Wouldn't be burdensome. It's to get it to the schools. I think, though, Americans tend to be skeptical and frustrated about whether their taxes will really work.
Yes.
When it comes to education, there's a very deep layer of skepticism about public education. It's not ideological. It's something
else. Well, Americans are deeply skeptical about many things, including the efficacy of government in general. And they have right to be, because the government in the 60s and 70s collapse, basically. I think. I mean, they did a poor job at just about everything. But on that note, Elizabeth, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a really great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Our guest has been Elizabeth Kiesch, director of the Keenan Ethics Center at Duke University.
And we also want to thank everyone in our studio audience. You've been a great audience, and we really appreciate it. Give yourself a round of applause.
And how about a round of applause for our guest? Because she was a great guest. So, John, are you wiser? I know you're a wise man, and it's hard to improve on your wisdom, but are you wiser today?
Yeah, you're making me feel bad, because I preach inequality, and then I exhibit such superlative skills at certain things.
Well,
yeah.
Now, tell me, what are your thoughts on race,
like
class,
modesty,
and inequality?
You know?
Yeah. Tell me
I think there was a central message today was the importance in imagination. Right? Really, I mean, institutional things are important. The shape of governments are important. Goodwill is important. But the key is imagination. At the one end, we have to have this equality of aspirational imagination. Maybe the most important part of equality is that everybody really can aspire and see a route, however more difficult it may be than someone else's, to getting to a good job, a good goal, and a good career. And we need the moral imagination of the other people, the ability to put yourself in the place of the poor, in the place of people of a different color or a different ethnicity. And I must admit, I think education in general and philosophy in particular has a lot to do to widen, broaden, and deepen the American capacity to imagine things.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think, but something that Elizabeth stressed that I think is really important is leadership. Because what do leaders do? What do real leaders do? They invite you to imagine a world with them. So I want you to imagine a world in which blah. And then he helps you, or she helps you, understand how to get there. Right? And I think that we haven't had for a long time leaders that challenged us to imagine enough. So I think that's a really important point.
Well, I do too. I think we've had some guys like the winner of the 2000 election, Al Gore, who were challenging us, but one way or another, they don't win, and they tend to be savaged by our media, not including ourselves.
So we're gonna draw this segment of our discussion to a close, but it continues as always on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is "Cogito ergo blogo." I think, therefore I blog.
Our programs are available in podcast form on our website.
I'd like to thank you all for listening, and thanks for watching.
And thank you for thinking. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
We owe special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Timpson, and Alan Farley. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, including the Stanford Humanities Center, the Office of the Dean of Research, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, and the Provost and President.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.